Good evening and welcome behind the news for January 30th. Is today the 30th? 2003. Copied last week's headers here, so I'm confused by the date. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two guests lined up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Joel Shalit, who is the editor of the Anti-Capitalism Reader, a collection of essays just published by Akashic Books. And then at 5:30, maybe a bit after, we'll speak with Christian Weller, an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, about a couple of reports he did for EPI over the last couple of few days. First of all, an analysis of the latest economic reports, GDP and such, coming out of the U.S. government, and also an examination of what war does to an economy. A lot of people think that war is good for the economy. It isn't always, and we'll have Christian Weller. So. Point of view on that. And also a reminder, my guest last week was Bill Pepper, author of the book An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, and he is speaking tonight. He's the keynote speaker for a Black History Month event at Columbia University, Alfred Lerner Hall, 116th Street and Broadway. And this is kind of short notice, but if you're nearby, he is speaking at about 6 o'clock or 6:30, somewhere around that time. Again, Alfred Lerner Hall, 116th and Broadway in Manhattan, Columbia University. And it's Bill Pepper, author of the book An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, a book that has gotten virtually no attention in the United States and only scant attention abroad, even though he has a pretty strong case that the assassination of Martin Luther King was a joint venture of the mafia and our own U.S. government, because he's just causing too much trouble, and he had to be gotten rid of. And I guess the only way we can get around the media blackout is through stations like this, WBAI. And now we're joined on the line by Joel Shalit, who is the editor of the Anti-Capitalism Reader, Imagining a Geography of Opposition, a book just published by Akashic Books, and also Akashic published last year, a book by Joel, original book of his own essays called Jerusalem Calling. And since we had an election in Israel just the other day, and we have Joel online, I thought I'd take advantage of things by asking him what he makes of the Israeli elections. Welcome to WBAI, Joel.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So what do you make of the apparent relatively overwhelming victory that Sharon clocked in Israel the other day?
Well, it's. I would say that it's overwhelming only in the sense that Sharon managed to obtain the majority of votes, if the lowest percentage of votes ever cast in an Israeli election. So it's something of a hollow victory for Sharon in that sense. Initial estimates were that only 1.5 million registered voters actually went out to vote. The final estimates that I saw coming out of Israeli periodicals in the last 2 days were that 68% of the Israeli electorate actually voted, and that this is a terrific reduction by Israeli standards, because one of the few things you can say has characterized Israeli voting patterns over the years is that it tends to have amongst the highest proportion of voters and most, in terms of national elections of any country in the world. I mean, generally they tend to hover between 75% and 90%.
Well, that's pretty amazing compared to the United States, where we're lucky to hit 50 on most elections.
Well, it's a lot more, as a society, it's a lot more ideologically turbulent.
And very divided.
Intensely divided. And it's, looking at the actual division of Knesset seats in the new Knesset, it seems almost evenly divided between what you would call, secular centrists and conservative nationalists and religious parties. And, it again seems very evenly divided down the middle. I mean, and this has been the case in Israel now since Rabin's assassination, if not since the mid-1980s, when you had a succession of coalition governments between Likud and Labor.
Now, the pundits I've been reading in the U.S. and press and the Financial Times and such have been speculating on what Sharon plans to do, what kind of government he plans to put together, and whether he's going to try for some history-making status as peacemaker, or he will be consistent with his own personal history and be an aggressive war maker. What's your read on what Sharon is going to be up to?
Oh, Sharon is the single most complicated political figure you could ever, you know, imagine. He defies any kind of logical analysis. You know, my sense is that maintaining you know, an extremely high level of violence benefits Sharon. He does everything in his power to maintain the status quo. You know. But I think he's smart enough to sense that eventually he's going to have to put a cap on the conflict, and the Israeli economy cannot sustain this indefinitely. And you know, Sharon himself is, though he is a military man, he is not necessarily a religious man, and he's a military nationalist, a secular military nationalist, and you know, the longer he perpetuates the conflict with the Palestinians, the more possibilities for a right-wing religious coalition will emerge that will replace Likud and Sharon's own particular milieu of political leaders. And if he wants to, you know, if he is as self-serving and narcissistic as he is historically proven to be, coming to a peace agreement by bringing in Labor and Shinui, who were the real winners of this election, the Change Party, Shinui means change in Hebrew, led by Yosef Lapid, will allow him to maintain his party, his party's hegemony, and his own personal political hegemony in Israel, which is really, in the end, all that matters for him.
And you mentioned Lapid and the Shinui Party, and from what I read about them, they it seems, of course, very secular and very opposed to the privileges that the Orthodox religious enjoy in Israel, but also a bit of a racist. It's the one quote I saw something about, he didn't want to fall victim either to the Arab ghetto or the Levantine dung heap, I think he put it.
Yeah, it's correct.
Yeah, Lapid, so what's he all about?
Lapid is a former talk show host. He's a more educated Jewish Rush Limbaugh. and I don't know. I mean, I think that's overdoing it on my part. Lapid is representative of the old Ashkenazi aristocracy in Israel. It's a very complicated, you know, political history and personal history. He's a Holocaust survivor as well. His party, Shinui, is really just a single platform party, which is essentially that it's the party of secularism. And, you know, from a sociological perspective, the fact that Israel has a party completely dedicated to creating a secular political environment in the country is fascinating, because he did what no left or center-left party has really managed to do in Israeli history, which is basically create an entire political constituency that was dedicated towards eliminating the role that religion plays in Israeli public life.
But now, how can you have a state that's organized as a Jewish state but secular? I mean, how do you keep religion out of it?
I'm not sure Lapid has an answer. Ultimately, the logic of Lapid's political platform is such that if Shinui were to be able to transform the Israeli state into a secular state, it would mean creating a binational state in which Judaism became a culture and a religion equal to all others that existed within the state of Israel. Ultimately. obviously the conclusions of what he's trying to do are very radical. And in that sense, he was able to absorb a large percentage of the leftist vote that participated in this election that normally would have voted for either Labor or the Meretz Party, which was the most high-profile leftist party in the country until this election.
And final question, Israel, before we move on to the anti-capitalism reading.
Sure.
You mentioned that the economy is in dire shape. I think it's about the worst it's ever been in Israeli history.
That's correct.
But it didn't seem to emerge as an election issue at all.
It just goes to show you that, I know. I'm continually surprised by the degree to which Israelis are able to put aside questions of the economy and concerns about the economy in favor of making the conflict with the Palestinians more important. There was a hilarious editorial in Haaretz, it must have been about a year ago, an opinion editorial written by some intellectual whose name completely passes me by, who argued, what if the economy was the single most important thing to Israelis? What if Israelis recognized that continuing to participate in a war with the Palestinians was just simply unprofitable? Would Israelis want to continue to participate in this war? And I think for Israelis, they've been so conditioned, so battered by 55 years of perpetual conflict that they are able to make matters of national security more important than their own economic life as a nation. And it's depressing. I think any good progressive movement in that country, as much as emphasizing the immorality of the continued occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, also has to stress that a continuation of the conflict is also a form of economic war against the Israeli middle class.
Okay, speaking with Joel Shalit, who is the author of the book Jerusalem Calling, which came out last year, and editor of a recently published book, The Anti-Capitalism Reader, Imagining a Geography of Opposition, both volumes published by Akashic Books, just across the river in Brooklyn. The Anti-Capitalism Reader, Imagining a Geography of Opposition is the subtitle. Why a geography? In the old days, we might have imagined an agenda or, the Trotsky's transitional program. But,
We love Trotsky. My sense was that I wanted to, by using the term geography, provide a sense, a literary sense of the wide spectrum of the diversity of political opinions informing what we generically call anti-capitalism, in order to push forward the notion that anti-capitalism, as a generally critical disposition towards the market, is not necessarily confined to a materialist worldview.
And I should say before continuing, in the interest of full disclosure, I've got several contributions to this volume, so there's a certain degree of self-interest, a very modest one, in my focusing on it. And let's go from the subtitle to the title, an anti-capitalism reader. In the old days, we might have said a socialist reader. This is conceived not as a positive evocation of another way of doing things, but at least presented in the title as a negative way. Why anti-capitalism?
The term itself is very useful in that ideally encompasses the variety of anti-market dispositions that are currently flourishing within the greater left today. Particularly because most or a very large percentage of the more evident anti-market forces amongst the worldwide left are not necessarily socialists. They're not necessarily Marxists. There's a lot of moralistic anti-capitalists, anarchist anti-capitalists. It's a much more open and less ideologically determined form of popular market criticism than that which existed during the Cold War.
No, I think a certain kind of old dinosaur leftist would say that uncertainty or variety of oppositions is a sign of weakness and disorder.
Oh, absolutely. A more orthodox Marxist would completely spank me for even celebrating that. You know, and I sympathize with that position, but at the same time, I think even from, you know, let's say a vanguardist position, one must legitimately look at the opportunities for the cultivation, you know, of anti-market sentiment where one can find it. You know, if you want to quote unquote direct it towards the right revolutionary goals, the sentiment has to be there to begin with.
And I mean, could give us a little survey of the field of what kinds of varieties of anti-market sentiments are out there that that the book touches on.
Well, the book, you know, despite the quote-unquote open nature of the book's attitude towards contemporary anti-capitalism, the book itself largely comes from a heterodox Marxist disposition, you know, rooted in the Frankfurt School and what you know more orthodox Marxists would call bourgeois or cultural Marxism. To a certain extent, there is an affinity for anarchist anti-capitalism in the book, at least an acceptance of it from a community of mostly Marxist writers.
And anarchism, of course, plays a very large role in American radicalism particularly, and especially among younger people, connection with punk culture and such. How do you reconcile that with a more Marxist point of view? How do the two traditions relate to each other?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for my anarchist friends and colleagues and the anarchist elements in the contemporary left, largely because the kinds of social movement politics they're interested in, hierarchies of contemporary radical social movements, what they envision is just radically democratic, and it's less, as I said earlier, it's less higher. Their vision of revolutionary social movements is far less hierarchical than anything we've witnessed during the Cold War, and I find that refreshing and fascinating, and I also see in the quote in the anarchist community a certain willingness to embrace a diversity of anti-market doctrines without necessarily being so willing to refuse to learn new political theory, new social theory, for fear of lapsing into what they, you know, quite often naively, you know, call a narrow-minded Marxist worldview. Well, there's a possibility for a new kind of synthesis in their openness, in their ideological openness, which heralds, you know, a developing new anti-market politics, which more closely approximates the kinds of positions on the market and on culture and society that we traditionally saw held by post-war Frankfurt School and French non-party Marxist thought.
Some of the contributors to the volume included my interview with the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who, by the way, I'm going to be interviewing in March, so
right on.
Here on this very radio station at this very hour. He has some critiques of anarchism in there, where he criticizes people on the left for being afraid of state power and for not acknowledging a covert hierarchy in many anarchist organizations.
Oh, absolutely.
Tom Frank, also in the interview in there, takes some of the cultural studies people to task for having a lot in common with a kind of right-wing libertarian point of view, individualism and anti-statism. And then there's another piece in there that talks about Giuliani's anti-welfare measures, getting people off welfare. Welfare is distributed by the state, and kicking them off is you know, you could say it's an anti-statist move. How can you how do people think about these relations with the state? Is this I certainly have a lot of sympathy with the idea that, state power is corrupting and dangerous, but on the other hand, how can you get anything done without the state?
Yes. most of the anarchists whom I know and associate with don't necessarily think about the state all that hard. They talk about smashing the state and this and that, but they're ardent defenders of welfare. You know, and I honestly think that the anarchist position on the state is a lot more fluid than their old school doctrinal rigidity on the subject leads those of us on the Marxist left to believe. And I think it's going to continue to evolve, and the youthfulness of this particular community certainly belies the fact that their opinions are going to change. And it's amazing what happens when you read classical critical theory with them, and notice that they really, for as radical and inspirational as their tradition can be sometimes, it's not that strong an intellectual tradition that it can't easily assimilate and be turned on by more traditional Marxist thought.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, who is the editor of the Anti-Capitalism Reader, Imagining a Geography of Opposition, just published by Akashic Books. Now, there's an interview in the book with the political theorist Wendy Brown, who talks about, has an interesting passage here, where she says, look, I think capitalism is not just inegalitarian, not just full of maldistributions of wealth, not wasteful of certain kinds of human, and she lists, several aspects of the critique. But that's a political critique of capitalism, not a scientific conclusion drawn from a set of contradictions, not a result that comes out of imagined dialectical movement of history. It's not an inner truth ultimately produced by capitalism. Rather, it's a political claim that will be contested radically by others. And she goes on. But I think what one of the points here I'm trying to bring out is that there is an awful lot or a lot less certainty about one's analysis and one's goals than there were a generation ago. To some people, liberating and to question a lot of assumptions. But it's also rather confusing. What do you preserve out of the Marxist tradition that doesn't hold on to this sense of science and revealed truth and destiny?
Oh, many things. I don't even know where to begin to answer you. I think, if you're going to try and isolate elements of the classical Marxist tradition that are carried on in this book, despite its heterodoxy, the authors in almost every instance have a very strong appreciation for dialectical analysis and dialectical thought, and see that as being essential in terms of being able to break down power and the inequalities created by market-driven societies in which the ideology of the free market is triumphant. I think that there's a very strong commitment to a materialist understanding of history being propelled by the continual negative interaction of classes and of capitalist development. I could go on. In this sense, it remains, regardless of the kind of abstractions indulged in and open-endedness indulged in interviews like that put forth by Wendy, in Wendy Brown's words, I would imagine that the book would come across as being also fairly conservative in terms of its adherence to what one would call the historical parameters of Western Marxist thought, for all of its alleged softness and lack of scientific clarity.
Well, you're also in the book, a lot of people are touching on kind of theoretical matters, whereas I think a lot of activists are much more interested in organizing and getting things done. What's the relation between that kind of activism and thought and theory of the sort that you present in this collection?
Well, I mean, I'd like to think that the book adhered to Theodore Adorno's famous axiom that theory is its own kind of political practice, and for today's contemporary activist crowd, you could translate that to be theoretical reflection being its own form of progressive political activism. It's very important that we continue to not restrict our definitions on the left of political labor solely to the realm of street politics. We have to continue to find a way to make room for intellectuals.
And in the interview that I did with Zizek in this volume, he brings out a critique of Chomskyist kind of analyses, where it's a matter of getting a better set of facts out there.
That's right.
We're lied to frequently in the media, and what we need to do is just get the truth out. And that's really the function of left journalists and academics, even. Is it just enough to get the facts out?
No, of course it's not. You also have to interpret. And the terrible tragedy of the American left, in my opinion, as epitomized to a certain degree by the kind of intellectual currents that flow through, such outstanding progressives as Noam Chomsky, is that there is a continued belief in the idea that truth is enclosed in facts and will reveal themselves to people if you simply present it to them. And that's just not true. It such a disposition so typical of the American left is simply that history will reveal itself to people without them having to make any effort to understand it on their own. It's almost as though this kind of worldview presupposes there's no such thing as alienation or ideology that would prohibit people from understanding what's good for themselves.
And finally, what's your evaluation of the state of the movement, whatever we're calling it these days? I mean, post-Seattle, kind of anti-capitalist movement, anti-IMF movement. It looked like it was thrown for a loop by September 11th, and now there's been a very encouraging and rapidly growing anti-war movement. What's your evaluation of it all right now?
I think that the growth of the anti-war movement and the fact that the anti-war movement has been built upon the anti-globalization movement and the social justice movements that made themselves very apparent at the end of the 1990s is absolutely terrific. The quote-unquote greater left could not be more healthy. In that sense, Bush is doing more harm than he is good in terms of creating through his policies, through his foreign policy in particular, helping spur the creation of the most healthy large political left in this country since the Vietnam War. So I'm optimistic. On that level, I love to see large anti-war demonstrations. I love to see these kinds of very considered public expressions of dissatisfaction with the status quo. Beyond that, I can't really offer you any other opinions. It's really, things are in a state of remarkable flux. I think it was very difficult during the 1990s to assume that there would ever be any kind of diversion from the kinds of political consensus and ideological consensus which prevailed during the Clinton years. I mean, look at how few people went out and protested the war in Kosovo. Look at how few people took a critical public disposition towards the continued bombing of Iraq throughout the 1990s. It seems like the cultural triumphalism which followed the Cold War had created a kind of ideological closure that no one could break out of. And that's why I see the current anti-war movement and the post-Seattle anti-capitalist movement as being signs of remarkable moral health on the part of the American and European publics.
And I know I said finally, but I lied. So let me ask one more question.
Sure.
I too am extremely encouraged by the kinds of things you're talking about, but it runs the danger. Naomi Klein, shortly after Seattle, I think, wrote a piece in which he worried that it was just becoming a movement of serial protest and with not much in the way of an agenda or any kind of organization. Does that concern you? I mean, especially given the influence of anarchists who are always skeptical about organization, can this sustain itself just on the basis of street protest and exuberance?
No, it can't, which is why intellectual projects like putting together anthologies of essays on anti-capitalism are important. And they're terrifically important because they are examples of people intellectually thinking through the abstractions which underlie the new street progressivism. It's absolutely important that we create safe spaces for leftist intellectuals to both examine and critique the social movement that they find that they find growing around themselves. To that end, I want to make sure to mention that there are a number of volumes like this attempting to do that exact same thing, such as, there was the Hatred of Capitalism book, which came out through, I believe, Semiotext last year. There's another anti-capitalism reader, which edited by Emma Burcham, which came out in the United Kingdom last year and will come out, which you're, I believe, a part of, is coming out through New Press in the United States this year. Am I correct about that?
Yes, I believe so.
Not to mention all of the anti-globalization readers, all of the new theory being written about globalization, colonialism, and world conflict. It's a time of tremendous intellectual ferment within the left, as much as it is a time of tremendous street politics and expressions of public dissatisfaction with the status quo, and the point, the responsibility that intellectuals have is to make sure that people recognize that both streams are both happening at the exact same time and equally valid.
And it's good for intellectuals when there are movements around, and it's good for movements when there are intellectuals around.
Absolutely.
And people can be both, not talking about two separate groups of people necessarily.
That's right.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, Joel.
Hey, thanks.
I've been speaking with Joel Shalit, who is the editor of the Anti-Capitalism Reader, Imagining a Geography of Opposition, published by Akashic Books, and also the author of a book published last year by Akashic, Jerusalem Calling, a set of essays and memoirs about growing up in the United States and in Israel and doing punk rock and radical politics. And we'll be back in just a moment with Christian Weller after this word from Tattoo. Back to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And that little musical interlude was somebody was. I heard one of the callers in the report to the listener complaining there wasn't enough diversity in the music. And how often do you hear Russian lesbian teeny bopper pop duos remixed as that was? That's Tattoo. And now we're joined by Christian Weller, who is an economist with the Washington, D.C. based Economic Policy Institute and author of an analysis of this morning's GDP figures released by the U.S. government, and also a piece from a couple of days ago, actually released yesterday, on the relation between war and the U.S. economy, and all on the EPI website, which is epi.org. And welcome to WBAI, Christian Weller.
Thank you very much for having us, Doug.
First of all, this morning, the Department of Commerce, the Bureau of Economic Analysis specifically, released its first estimates for gross domestic product last year, and the fourth quarter of last year, rather. They will subsequently revise this many times in the future, but this is the first take we've got. And it showed virtually no growth in the U.S. economy in the fourth quarter. What did it look like, Christian?
Well, the number that we got for the fourth quarter on an annualized basis is 0.7%. That's pretty much flat growth. We kind of expected it. We had some advance warning for this coming from the Federal Reserve Bank's survey of its member banks. In particular, the retail sector was really, really weak. The holiday shopping season was particularly weak. And if you look at the numbers, the one thing that really stands out is how small the increase on consumption was. It increased by only 1%. That's the smallest increase in almost 10 years. Really, I mean, the consumer, I think, is maxed out on the consumers are maxed out on their credit cards.
Now, the standard analysis has been that the supply side of the economy has been weak. That is, businesses have not been investing very aggressively. At least the consumer was holding things up by spending freely. And even spending through what looked like a rather recessionary period. Is this the end of the consumer now?
I think this is the end of it. Because what you've got to remember is the last two quarters, the third quarter and the fourth quarter, when you look at what retailers did to get consumers basically to get them into their shops, is they really pulled out all stops. Discounts, 0% financing, 50% discounts even before the holiday shopping season. And people just didn't bite. And that really is a result of a number of factors. People, I think, are uncertain about the future, both the economic future as well as the overall global political perspective. And they're also uncertain about how they're going to pay back all the debt that they have accumulated during the recession. So I think that really ultimately piled on so much uncertainty that people said, okay, well, stop. Enough is enough. We can't really go and spend more money and shop more. And if the consumer is not going, if people don't go to the malls and the shops and buy the stuff, there's really no incentive for investments, for investors, for business to invest more in new capacity because they already have enough capacity. And this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. I mean, we see this globally. Our exports are doing particularly poorly. We're not selling stuff overseas, although the dollar is falling, which should help our exports. And so you have three out of four sectors in the economy right now struggling, and that leaves you with the government. And the federal government clearly is spending increasing amounts, especially in its preparations for a possible war. But outside of Washington, the state and local governments are struggling with budget deficits, with possible tax increases, and possible expenditure cutbacks. So there's not much happening on the states either. And I think the federal government has to carry the water at this point for the economy, but I think there's not enough happening on that side.
I want to get back to the government question in a bit, but two things. First of all, the other thing that's been holding up the economy has been that households have been very aggressive about buying houses and at higher prices. How's the housing sector doing now?
The housing sector is holding up remarkably well. We still see relatively good growth rates. It's just not a huge sector of the economy. I mean, part of it, what we see in the housing sector was, part of the activity in the housing sector was a lot of refinancing. We still see it relatively strong. But I think that may come to an end, too, for the same reasons that we see a slowdown in consumption, that people ultimately will take a wait-and-see attitude given the uncertainty associated with the political and economic environment.
And what about investment, business investment in particular, which is really a very crucial part of long-term growth?
Well, business investment is really the factor we've been watching for quite some time. If you look at the numbers, this is the first quarter where the data shows a slight uptick in investment. However, that follows 8 straight quarters of decline, which we've never seen before. And we've lost a lot of investment capacity. People really have been pulling back on that sector. The investment picture is a little bit mixed. We have seen some increases for a little while now on computer-related investment. And I think people need to be very careful when looking at those numbers. Some analysts misinterpret that, in my view, as the start of another internet boom. And part of it is it's just replacement investment. Computers and software become obsolete very quickly. Businesses have not invested in those capacities for 2 to 3 years. It's just time for them to buy new computers. So I think that's just in the nature of the beast. I don't think it means that there's going to be another high-tech boom waiting for us around the corner. In other investment goods, we still see large declines, in particular in commercial construction, for instance, where we have large overcapacities in many, many areas. It's often a regional phenomenon, obviously San Francisco, but also Raleigh-Durham or the Texas-Dallas area. So I think, but that overall, still we see a lot of declines there. And that will not turn around anytime quickly. As far as I can tell, all the reports indicate for a lot of overcapacity.
I'm speaking with Christian Weller, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and author of a couple of recent reports on the EPI website, which you can find at epinet.org, epinet.org. And what about the foreign sector? The report on the website highlights this as a pull quote, as we say in the journalism trade. For the first time, the U.S. trade deficit has risen above $500 billion, a record 4.3% of GDP. What does that mean, first of all? Just define what the terms are there, and what is the importance of it?
Yeah, I think we need to pay a lot of attention to that one, to what's happening on the trade side. What the number means is we're right now on an annualized basis. We're spending about $500 billion more. This is a real number. We're spending over $500 billion more in imports than we're exporting overseas. Those $500 billion still need to be financed. If we buy more stuff from overseas, we need to have foreign currency. We get that foreign currency by borrowing from overseas investors. However, that borrowing is not free. Overseas investors want to have dividend payments and interest payments. So we have this debt stock sitting around after decades of trade deficits that debt has to be serviced. And that is a drag on our national income. Usually the rule of thumb is, and if you add those two together, and that's really the important picture, if you add the trade deficit, the difference between goods and services that we import and the goods and services that we export, plus the debt service that we have to do on our national debt that we owe to foreigners, if we add those two together, we're spending more than 5% of GDP right now of our gross domestic product on just sending overseas. And that ultimately becomes an unsustainable proposition. It's a self-fulfilling growth process, because the more we borrow now, the more we have to pay in debt service in the future. And usually, for most emerging economies, for instance, once you reach about 5% of GDP in this deficit, you get into a very unstable crisis situation. This is a situation that Argentina was in just before the crisis hit a little over a year ago. The U.S. is different from Argentina. We're stronger. We have a reserve currency that everybody wants. But what we have seen already is that overseas investors are somewhat pulling back. They're becoming more reluctant to bring their money to the United States. They see this as an unsustainable situation. The prime example is the Chinese central bank that has been moving money from U.S. dollars into the euro. I think that's really the one thing we need to keep in mind. Overseas investors right now don't have to put their money into dollars. They do have another option. The euro is a real currency. It's trading. in international markets. It has a large financial following. And if investors want to go out of the dollar, they can go into euros. And the euro is appreciating right now, which makes it even more attractive for international investors to pull out of the dollar and into the euro. Now, what does that mean for us? Well, the dollar falling in the long run is probably a good thing, like let's say in 2 years or so, because it will make our exports cheaper and hence people will buy more American products. It will also make imports more expensive and hence people will turn more to domestic product. But we have lost so much capacity in the very crucial manufacturing sector that in the meantime, for like say like the next year, year and a half, we still have to import the same amounts that were imported maybe last year. And as we import the same amounts but at rising prices, our trade deficit is actually rising. It's a phenomenon called the J-curve, but that doesn't matter. Basically, it's this phenomenon that you see the dollar falling, but contrary to conventional wisdom, the trade deficit is rising, and that can put a large burden on our economy. So I think for the next year, year and a half, I would say the trade deficit is about to continue to rise before we see an improvement there. And it's something we really need to worry about because the dollar could fall dramatically if investors get really scared off with the U.S. economy.
Yeah, and this is a point I think it deserves some emphasis. It might be a little bit arcane, but we have this very large deficit that needs to be financed, as you say. We run up debts overseas in order to finance that deficit. The debt gets larger and larger and larger, and we require constant inflows of foreign capital to just keep going. And, of course, the risk is that at some point those investors abroad will cease to be so kind and maybe not merely stop putting money in here, but ask for some of their old money back. And
right.
That would be a considerable danger. How serious a risk is that, do you think?
I think it is a serious risk. We have seen some changes already for a year now that investors have, overseas investors, they're still bringing money here, but they're investing in much more short-term investments, what we call portfolio investment. It used to be more foreign direct investment, buying up companies, buying up real estate. Now it's more just very, very short-term, like money in CDs or in treasury bills and that kind of stuff. Money that can be withdrawn very quickly. And I think that's really ultimately the danger. If that happens, we have a number of options. But given the current constellation at the central bank, at the Fed, and in the political climate, I think that the main option that people will revert to is rising interest rates, which is the opposite of what the economy needs and what a weak economy needs. But it's a standard phenomenon for any crisis country. I mean, you look at Thailand, you look at Indonesia, you look at Argentina, many of these countries had no other, basically reverted once capital started leaving their economies. They reverted to rising interest rates, thereby pushing their economy into recession, thereby pushing money even further, faster out of their economy. It's kind of a vicious cycle that you'll find yourself in.
Well, that's a standard IMF prescription for a smaller, poorer country, is if you face a run on capital, that you have to raise interest rates and hope that people will stick around. But when you raise interest rates, it drives the real economy into the tank.
It does, and so just to be, I mean, it's true, most of the economies that have undergone large financial crises have been smaller economies, but some of them have been industrialized economies. The Nordic countries underwent a similar crisis in the early 1990s, Sweden, Finland. And really, this is a crisis. Right now, the trade deficit is in historically high proportions. We've never had this situation. We've never had a problem of this size. So it's hard to predict what this will mean for the U.S. economy. And again, the one thing we have to remember is this is a unique constellation since World War II, where the problem is as large as never been before. And there is an alternative for international investors, which has never existed before, and that is the euro.
And, of course, the United States, I mean, we've seen crises in other countries, but the United States, of course, is such a colossus and such a heavily armed colossus that we really can't imagine, I don't think, what any kind of structural adjustment would mean for the United States.
Well, I think the common wisdom on conventional, on structural adjustment will be rewritten very quickly once it affects the United States. I would not be surprised if, in a crisis situation, the policy makers and leaders in Washington will rearrange their thinking and all of a sudden propose capital controls, which is the alternative to raising interest rates. You just simply stop the money from leaving. I mean, that's what Malaysia did in the middle of a crisis.
And of course, the United States gets very upset when other countries try to do that. But when bad things happen here, then all those rules go out the window.
Hypocrisy has never stopped us from policy.
It certainly hasn't. So now this gives me an opportunity to switch to the other aspect of what you've been writing about lately, and that is the effects of war in the economy. Some people are saying that, yeah, the economy is looking weak now. We just can't recover from recession. But nothing like a little war spending to goose it back up into prosperity. Is that a fair judgment?
Well, my research is focused on a slightly different aspect, and I'll talk about that in a second. I think the proposal, I mean, a war is not a good economic policy. The costs in, just in terms of human life are way too high for that. But just from a purely economic perspective, we don't know how big the war is. Nobody has given any clear scenarios what this war would look like.
And Larry Lindsey got fired in part for saying $200 billion.
Right. I mean, the estimates go from $100 to $200 billion, possibly higher. That is one thing that I think people need to keep in mind, that the estimates vary very widely. But the other part is also, and I think that's very important, there's so many unknowns in this equation. We don't know what this will do to oil prices. We don't know. The other thing that a friend of mine have been pointing out is it could lead to a wave of anti-American sentiment in many of our overseas markets and thereby depressing our exports. It could drive international investors out of U.S. markets and thereby depressing the dollar and thereby kind of precipitating the crisis scenario we just talked about. The other part is contrary to the effort, the war effort in the early 1990s, the U.S. has been struggling finding foreign allies for its war effort in the Gulf. And that means that the U.S. may have to go out and actually spend the money not in the United States but overseas. Take the example of Turkey. Turkey so far has said it would not allow the U.S. to use bases in Turkey for a war in Iraq. And maybe the U.S. has to wave a few billions or tens of billions of dollars in the face of Turkey to make that palpable for them. So it really is as I think there's too much uncertainty in there. I think most of these issues speak against any large effect from a war effort on the economy. On the contrary, I think it actually speaks for a negative effect. But let's say even if it has a positive effect from increased government defense spending, my research basically just points out that even if there's a positive effect, we have to pay the bill once the war ends. Because if you increase defense spending, there really aren't that many civilian uses for that kind of spending, for that kind of investment. So once the war ends, you basically stop production for the war, you have the troops coming home, and you actually, what you see is you see a large drop in growth rates and you see a rise in unemployment. The drop, the calculated drop in growth rates from before the recession hits until after the recession hits, in my calculation, is 4.5 percentage points. That's quite significant.
About a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate as well.
Right. And in this case, it's not clear what a war would do actually to to our unemployment rate, which has increased quite significantly. So it could come on top of what we already have. So I think we have to be very careful when proposing war as an economic policy. I think the benefits, the short-term benefits, are very questionable. And once the war ends, there will be a price that has to be paid for any benefits that we may see before the war is over.
And I should say that I think the Weekly Standard, the conservative magazine, has an editorial this week's issue or last saying that war is the Bush administration's economic policy, and that's a good thing. And so this is not just a fantasy that the war is being perceived as an economic policy.
To be honest, on the State of the Union, it was the clearest laid out policy of all of them. And it was, the rest of the stimulus package that the president laid out has no real stimulus effect. So.
All right, well, we're out of time, so we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Christian Weller.
You're very welcome, Doug.
Christian is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Remember Bill Pepper speaking about the assassination of Martin Luther King at Columbia University, Alfred Lerner Hall, 116th and Broadway, starting right about now. So if you're nearby, scurry on over. And Alfred Lerner Hall, 116th and Broadway, William Pepper, author of An Active State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. And we'll go out with this bit, another bit from Tattoo, and stay tuned for the news. And on into the evening until next week. Goodbye.